us time and time again. To live like there's no God makes you a fool. If you want to see kids live right, stop handing out condoms. Start handing out the word of God in school.
The only hope for America is Jesus. The only hope for a country is Him.
We repent of our ways. Stand firm and say we need God in America again.
I'm Zach. I'm a musician, a former worship leader. I helped destroy Mars Hill Church, and I'm not really sure what I believe anymore.
I'm Gabe. I'm a Bible theology nerd, an occasional preacher, a movie buff, and I'm an evangelical.
And which, by association, means you are an American. Congratulations.
I'm an American.
This is Veterans of Culture Wars.
I listened to Carmen in the 90s. Veterans of Culture Wars is a podcast where we talk about the beliefs, history, culture, and personal stories from evangelical Christianity. We welcome you to the podcast, whether you are a believer or not. And for this episode, we are recording Wednesday, March 9th, and there is still currently being a war being waged in the Ukraine. Putin's forces have invaded.
Ukraine.
Yes. And today we received disturbing news reports of Putin's forces bombing a children's hospital and maternity ward. Casualties continue to mount up and will most certainly be more in the future once people get a count on the destruction and senseless violence that is happening with this war. And we bring this up because Russia plays into what we are going to discuss on today's episode. Vladimir Putin is a Christian nationalist, and he had supposedly, or what he alleges was a religious awakening or experience in 1993 after a car crash involving his wife at the time. And so Russia operates as a far-right kind of nationalistic sort of country. And that type of Christian nationalism is not just something that is over in the country of Russia and their government. There's also brands or streams of Christian nationalism here in the United States, which we prominently obviously saw on display on January 6th, 2021. And we have seen in the past 5 years ties between white Christian nationalists stateside and even Putin's regime in Russia. So we're going to talk about these things tonight on the Veterans of Culture War podcast. Christian nationalism and Christo-fascism are topics that we have wanted to discuss on the VCW podcast for a while now. And fortunately for us, a foremost thinker, podcaster, and writer on these matters said yes to coming on our show. So our guest is a professor at the University of San Francisco teaching philosophy of religion. He is a counselor at the Center for Trauma Resolution and Recovery, helping people with religious trauma. He is the co-host of the popular podcast, Straight White American Jesus. And importantly, he has a book coming out on January 6th, 2023. It's called Preparing for War, The Extremist History of White Christian Nationalism and What Comes Next. Brad Onishi is with us. How are you?
I'm great. That was a flattering introduction. I'm blushing. So I'm trying to just say I'm glad to be here. But I was raised in a house where we didn't talk like that. So getting that kind of introduction is always hard for me. So anyway, thanks y'all for having me. It's a true honor. And just, you know, seeing what y'all do here and the guests you've had, it's pretty cool to get invited. So thanks for having me.
I assume that you recognized in some way the song that I played before the introduction. A lot of folks may know that the original artist was Carmen. It was America, again, from his album, The Standard. Now, this was a video I found on YouTube with 821 previous views. It is performed by a lady in combat fatigues at a church, and it was posted on November 6, 2016. So 2 days before the election that ushered in the king of white nationalism, Donald Trump. And I thought that was a pretty incredible document to share. So were you a fan of Carmen growing up?
You know, it's interesting. I converted when I was 14, and that was 1994, right? And so by the time I was really a Jesus freak, I was like a freshman in high school. And I feel like I got in right when we definitely were into Carmen. Like Carmen was everywhere and Carmen was a thing. Don't get me wrong. But we also were like trying to be a little edgy. And so we were like doing the Christian punk thing. Mm-hmm. We had the MXPX going. We had POD. You know, I'm Southern California. So unfortunately, there was a ska phase.
The Supertones, the OC Supertones.
OC Supertones, Five Iron Frenzy. Those were our jam for a while. So anyway,
if Oscar Isaac can be in a Christian ska band, then it's all right. There's grace for anyone else. did you ever play in any bands?
My brother's the musician, but no, I have no musical talent to speak of at all. Yeah.
I had a friend in a Christian ska band named Skalleluyah, and I have to believe that there were like at least 20 of those around the country. It's too obvious of a name, but
oh man. Now that's a wild story because I also converted to Christianity at the age of 14 in 1994. I think we're the same age. And I heard another interview where you mentioned that your dad was he was involved in a Buddhist temple. Was that out in Hawaii? And I'm curious how religion kind of factored in as you were growing up and how you found your way kind of into evangelical church.
Yeah. So you know, it's interesting. My dad grew up in Maui and he was Buddhist in a way that a lot of folks like in the South are Baptist. Went to temple every weekend. He went there for Japanese school. Like that's where he went for Japanese classes when he was 5 and 8 years old. He mowed the lawn, right? Like grandma pulling him by his ear to, hey, go mow the lawn at the church or whatever. And when I was like 12, 13, I was like in ways that portended being a religion professor. I was like fascinated with the meaning of life. And I asked him like, hey, can you teach me about Buddhism? And he gave me a book like of the Buddhist teachings. And I thought it was because he'd read it. And he was going to like, once I read it, he would talk to me about it. And it's because he didn't know a damn thing about Buddhism. He just was trying to get me off his back. The point of that for me is like, we grew up culturally sometimes going to Buddhist stuff. Same with mom. My mom's a white woman from Tennessee. So we sometimes like once in a blue moon would go to a Christian thing, but my conversion was really, got invited to Wednesday night youth group by my eighth grade girlfriend and was kind of getting in trouble at the time. And there was no way mom could say no to me going to church. So like, hey, it's Wednesday. I'm going to go to church, mom. And she's like, this sounds good. You've been getting in trouble. You've been mouthing off. So my goal was just to like see my girlfriend, get away from the Bible study, go make out in the field, whatever. And then lo and behold,
we don't actually say make out on this podcast. Dave, you're going to need to. Yeah.
We'll do some beeps. No.
Can bleep that. I apologize. You sent me the list of words ahead of time and I just blatantly ignored it. So anyway, all that to say, not religious household. And so when I convert, I mean, it takes like 6 months, but I'm in. And I don't know how it went for you, Dave, but like I was like, you know, my whole life was Jesus. And so my dad, it was hard for him. It was really hard for him. He didn't want me to go to church. He didn't want me to be short-term mission trip to Mexico. I mean, that stuff, he hated that. So it was, it was a whole thing in our house for sure.
Which do you think he disliked more, your faith or your interest in ska?
No, I don't know that I would have gotten into ska without my faith. And so I blame,
could have been the reason, really.
I blame the ska phase on Jesus. So, you know, I don't know if that's fair or not, but I think I was a Jesus freak, you know, and that was our song, you know, maybe I'm a Jesus freak, but then sure. very quickly it was Orange County Supertones, and we had bleached hair. It was bad. I mean, there's photos. I've tried to get them scrubbed from the internet. I have not been totally successful. So yeah.
Yeah. I bleached my hair as well. It took like an hour each time and just like burned my scalp because I had such dark hair. It was a bad idea.
Yeah. I did in college. That was pretty late to do that kind of stuff.
You did?
Oh yeah. Just once. Way behind the times, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I was a senior in college or something, but yeah, anyways. And Brad, I think I saw in your bio, you were actually a pastor at some point too, right? You're an ex-evangelical pastor. Like, how did that go? What denomination did you teach in? And what do you make of that part of your life?
Yeah. So I grew up in North Orange County. So like kind of on the border of Orange County and LA County. And that, if anyone knows that part of the state in California, that's Richard Nixon territory. So I'm born in the city where Richard Nixon's born, and Richard Nixon's famously a Quaker, right? So in my town growing up, we actually had two Quaker churches that were mega churches, like with over 2,000 people. Mm. And you're like,
mega churches? Wow.
Yeah. Yep. That's not a thing. Wow. But it is, because what the Orange County Quakers did is they took all the cool stuff about being Quaker out. Social justice, abolitionism, egalitarianism, you know, waiting on the Holy Spirit, all of that stuff. And they just sort of
fireplaces.
Yeah. Yeah. and they really just turned it into the kind of seeker sensitive model. Right. And so, yeah, it's super weird. So I converted in that church. That's where I was at 14. And by the time I was 18, they hired me part-time when I graduated high school to kind of be an intern to work with the youth group. And then when I was 20, like a day after my second year of college ended, I got married. And then there was a big controversy with the youth pastor, and he was fired quickly, and they offered me the job on an interim basis. And then I took over permanently. So when I was 20, I was full-time minister, married, and going to school at a Christian college. And that was a lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot. I mean, at least since you were already married, you weren't the 20-year-old youth pastor who ends up marrying one of the kids in the youth group.
Youth pastors I know are like public enemy number one in certain circles on Twitter, and I get it, and whatever. But I was not that youth pastor. Never had any, you know what I mean? None of that business happened.
You know, I went to Mars Hill for 9 years.
And I know, I was going to say.
Yeah. Driscoll spent a lot of time making fun of youth pastors. And yeah, that's one area that I think he was totally right. I'll hand that to him.
Oh, man. The thing for me with youth ministry was like, that's how I got saved. You know what I mean? I was 14. And so my whole thing was like, I'm going to go out and get those punk skater kids that I used to be. And we're going to not do this whole church kid thing. We're going to do the, like, you know, we had a skate park at the, you know, we did all that business. It was like, it was that kind of thing for me. But yeah, anyway,
I unfriended one of my youth leaders in the last year, 'cause she went full QAnon.
Yep.
And I got no patience for that.
Yep.
Well, tonight, thank you for sharing your story. And we wanted to talk about Christian nationalism and Christo-fascism, just from what I think we all have experienced in the past 5 years. And then there's just really kind of eerie connections too, in ways, with what's happening with Putin being a sociopath and invading the Ukraine. And Russia is essentially like a model of Christian nationalism in their high government. Maybe before we go into it, should we define, just for the listeners, like what Christian nationalism is, and then what Christo-fascism is? Is there a difference? Is it kind of the same thing? How are we thinking about those terms?
You know, in my mind, I think a really handy way to think about Christian nationalism is, do you believe the country was built for and by Christians, right? And so is the country a Christian country in the sense that Christians built it and that it is for Christians? And that may seem like a really low bar because so many Americans fit into that category, but it really does sort of provide just a very handy way into thinking, okay, if you think the flag and the cross, if you think the Constitution and the Bible go together, not because of your personal preference, but because that is culturally and politically how things are and should be in the country, then that is Christian nationalism. Now, some people are kind of Christian nationalist light, right? They're not trying to push this vision. It's not a model for expulsion or marginalization in their minds, at least. It's just that they think, yeah, you know, we had a Christian founding and I'm a Christian and I think America is best if it's a Christian place. That may not lead to overwhelming violence or, you know, fascism, as you're saying, Dave. On the other hand, what we know is that if you add in race to this, it gets a little bit more telling, right? So if you're a Black Christian nationalist, and there are Black Christian nationalists, they often see the country as having never lived up to its promise. And what they want from their sort of understanding of the country and their faith is for the United States to finally live up to its promises of equality and liberty and independence and the pursuit of all the things promised in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and so on. When you add in the white part, and this is from data, this is not just me spouting off, you can read all the great work by Sam Perry and Andrew Whitehead, by Catherine Stewart, by Ryan Burge, by Paul Zschäpe. There's a new book coming out by Phil Gorski and Sam Perry. When you add in white, what you get is not, hey, we hope the country will become what it's supposed to be. It's, we hope the country will become once again what it was. And there's this vision, right, this nostalgia for a country that was once ordered the right way, right, with the right people in charge, the right kinds of people of faith who were making the decisions, the right kinds of people. And religion in many cases here is a kind of way to hide race, right? You know, people will talk about good old Christian folks, good old people of faith, and it's a code, right, for white folks, straight white folks, straight white native born folks, people who were born in the country and don't speak with an accent, that kind of stuff. And so when we start getting there, the data tells us that white Christian nationalists are most likely to reinterpret American history in ways that don't correspond to the historical record. They're most likely to think we should restrict voting. They're most likely to think that police brutality does not exist as a major problem in the country. They're most likely to think that we should restrict the things we teach in school and not talk about slavery and Jim Crow and Chinese exclusion and so on. And so race is a big part of this. Whenever we talk about Christian nationalism, I think we have to talk about white Christian nationalism. And that leads into Christian fascism, which I'll just say quickly. Some folks take their Christian nationalism so far that they're willing to trade in democracy if it means having the nation in the way they want it, right? And so if we're willing to give up democracy, and that means that we get a country that has really strict abortion laws, that is pursuing and investigating and hunting trans people, if we can make sure that almost no immigration happens in any way, if we can make sure our school curricula are purged of any uncomfortable material about slavery or gay rights, that's great. And if we have to do that and not have democracy, it might be worth it. So yeah, Christian fascism, Christian supremacy, I'll do that, right? If that means I get a country that I want in the way that I want it. And I guess to me, that's kind of how those two things work on a kind of continuum.
Growing up in evangelical circles and going to a Christian school, you know, I heard all the time that, well, we're not in a democracy. It's yeah, a republic. And I forget exactly what the difference is between the two, but that was really important for them to make that distinction. You write about Matt Shea, the Eastern Washington I want to accent the far, but they're all far right now, right? but a far right guy that was actually kicked out for being too far right.
Is he a 3%er? Is that the group, or is that another?
I forget if he was, but he is, you know, from Spokane. You're right. He's a pastor now. But he like adamantly said, you know, that he is anti-democracy, that democracy is what got us in this terrible predicament, that democracy is the enemy of Christians in this country. How common is that feeling? And is the it's not a democracy, it's a republic, just a polite way of saying the same thing?
It's not a democracy, it's a republic. Whenever I hear that, it's a code, right? It's a code for saying democracy is too willy-nilly. It lets anybody have a say. Anybody gets a voice. And we don't want that. We can't have non-Christians, immigrants. We can't have the trans person of color. We can't have the non-binary person. We can't have, right, the globalist or the socialist. Like, if they have a voice and they get to vote and they might get into office, that scares the bejesus out of us. You know, Sam Perry always says that Christian nationalism is about order. And if you need to use violence to get that order, then that's justified because you feel like you're pursuing a social order that is ordained by God, right? And so this whole idea that democracy is not necessarily good, I think in the 90s, as we were just talking about, right? Not that common. Not a lot of folks want to say that out loud in your neighborhood church, even in your mega church where everybody's got the Hawaiian shirt and the rock band. Not a lot of folks want to walk around and be talking like that. It's, hey, seeker friendly, get everyone in church. Let's go to summer camp. Let's have a latte and get people to Jesus. Right. I think the difference with the Trump years is that kind of sediment is totally out in the open and it is spreading like ivy. I mean, it is catching fire. It's totally okay in those settings, in those Facebook groups, in those spaces to say, yeah, you know, God, it's not like democracy is sacred. Who needs democracy? What we need is, right, what God's will. And if God's will means we need an authoritarian leader to lead us to a place where we have the right kind of country, then let's go for it. I mean, democracy was never sacred. It was Jesus. You know, it's God who's sacred. It's God who ordains government, God who is in control. So has that stuff been around? Of course. The difference for me is you hear that from the common person now, not the theologian, not the Reconstructionist in Idaho, not the like far right Dominionist in an obscure place. You hear that up and down, right? Mainstream Christian culture now, and that to me is what's a little bit scary about our current moment.
The rise in accepting the inevitability of just violence. Yeah. Has been really fascinating, and it's I don't think that Democrats seem to understand how widespread that feeling is. I think it was in the State of the Union address the other day that I heard Biden talking about, you know, common sense gun control measures and saying, you know, you don't need weapons of war to go out deer hunting. And I'm just like, they don't want them for deer hunting. Like, that is not the issue at all, buddy. People are stocking up arsenals for the next January 6th as they stocked them up for that January 6th. Like, they are preparing for violence because they have accepted that that is necessary. They'll love that quote all the time of, you know, they got to refresh the tree of liberty with the blood of patriots or whatever. Like, this is not guns are no longer a debate about hunting tools.
Right.
What were we going to say, Dave?
Oh, I was going to back up what he was saying about the 1990s when I first became a Christian was kind of in, I was even in a very conservative environment that the political issues that would be talked about were pro-life ones and definitely anti-LGBT, anti-gay marriage at that point. All that aside, like in the 1990s, there was, I mean, I think as a teenager, I was a part of the religious right because I bought into people talk about the early 60s Supreme Court decision that took prayer out of school and that we need to get prayer back in school. And that would end these school shootings that were popping up. And like, we need to get God to kids in school and allow this to happen. And so that was the flavor of the religious right. It wasn't, you know, no one that I remember ever advocated violence, but it was definitely like, we need to have Jesus influencing people in critical spots in order to talk about Christianity to classrooms and to others in society.
I totally agree. I feel like I was in a very similar space, and you know, our focus was on, like, we did see you at the poll. Let's go pray for our school and our country. Right.
You know, I do that at my Christian school, which is ridiculous. Yeah. That's basically just a preschool assembly. Just everybody's there.
But we, you know, I just totally agree. It was talk was about abortion. Murphy Brown was having a baby on TV with no husband. That was Dan Quayle was very mad about this.
And Will and Grace came out.
Will and Grace, Bill Clinton had a thing, you know, with an intern. And so what I remember, and I wonder if y'all remember this, is like leading up to the George W. Bush years, there was this talk of like, whoa, could we actually have a Christian president, you know, a real Christian, what we considered a real Christian. Mm-hmm. And there was this like naivete, this excitement about what would happen, you know, it would change everything. And I really feel like folks forget that the Bush years were this crescendo that was unsatisfying. Like it didn't go far enough. You know, even as far as Bush went with the wars and everything else, he was not a barbarian. He was not going to just bulldoze things over to kind of get what people wanted.
Well, and not so in this country.
Yeah. No. And don't, yeah. Please. And guys, don't mistake me. There's no praise or I have no nostalgia for George W. Bush. What I'm saying though, is this like, before his election, I feel like there was a sense in that Christian culture of like, this would be amazing if this happened. If you fast forward, by the time we get to the end of like Obama's presidency, it's like, no, we don't need a Bush. I don't want another legacy kid. I don't want another American dynasty. You know what I want? I want a barbarian.
Oh yeah. I mean, his thing was compassionate conservatism. Yeah. And they learned they don't want compassion. They want dominance. But yeah, I remember like there was a popular book. I remember my mom had it, like The Faith of George W. Bush.
Yep.
There was a very concerted effort to inflate his evangelical bona fides, even though by most accounts, you know, he had led a very carefree existence for most of his life and had an eventual come to Jesus moment. Right. But he was not a shining example of an evangelical life in for the most part. But I'm wondering if you may have a little insight into this. When you're talking about Christian nationalism being predicated on the idea that America was founded as and to be a Christian nation, I'm wondering, I suspect it's just because of the relatively smaller numbers, but I wonder why it's talked about so much with evangelicals, leading that when there's a fair amount of LDS people in this country and their religion is America is central to the whole thing. You know, Jesus visited America and he's going to return to like Missouri or something. Right. So I'm wondering if you know something about the strains of white nationalism in Mormon groups and in LDS groups.
Yeah. I think you're making a really good point, which is a couple things. Christian nationalism is not isolated to evangelicals, and it's often talked that way lazily, and it's just not right. So if you look at the numbers, large chunks of white Catholics, right, just totally fit this bill. Right. Mm-hmm. And as you're saying, and especially in this part of the country, California, Utah, Idaho, Washington, Arizona, there's a lot of LDS communities definitely fall in there too. Now, I think what happens with the Latter-day Saints is in American consciousness, they don't play a central role. So the person in Massachusetts, the person in Florida, the person in Louisiana, the person in Kansas maybe has never met a Mormon person, right? Mm. Maybe has no real clue of what happens in Mormon doctrine or Mormon history or Mormon visions of American kind of foundings and returnings and all that kind of stuff. So I think the larger point for me is that white Christian nationalism is not limited to white evangelicals. I think we need to get over that. Catholics, Mormons, there's some Jews that fit in there weirdly in some sense. But it's even beyond that. It's not about religious commitment or practice. It's more about an ethnic traditionalist identity, right? Yeah. Yeah. And the Christian part is really important because what the Christian part is not, hey, I, and like we all did in the 90s, I have a quiet time every day. I go to Bible study on Wednesday. I go to church on Sunday. I have a small group on some other day. I'm doing a devotional. I'm going to summer camp. I'm going to men's retreat. No. Christian nationalism is, the Christian is a nice cover for a lot of stuff underneath, right? An ethnic identity, a white identity, right? That comes very close to just saying, right, white folks are the people who should be in charge of the country and the dominant group. It's a traditionalist view that says, I don't like the idea that there's more than two genders. I don't like the idea that we have to consider American history and all its complexity and all of its tragedy. I don't like the idea that I have to consider other people when it comes to holidays or celebrations or anything else. I want to say Merry Christmas. I don't want to admit that there's people who don't celebrate Christmas. The way I always put it is Christian nationalism, the Christian is like a cover. And it's a really positive code word, right? Because if I say, hey guys, I'm Brad, I'm a white nationalist. Everyone's like, oh, okay. Like, maybe some folks want to talk to me. Matt Shea does, but there's a lot of folks that are like, no, I can't appear with this guy in a political campaign. I don't want to stand next to you at the thing. Right. But if I say, hey y'all, what's up? I'm Brad. I'm a man of faith. I'm a dad, I'm a husband, and I'm a Christian. And I believe this country is a Christian nation. And everyone's like, come on in, partner. That sounds good. That sounds great. Me too. Right. And that is a nice covering for a lot of stuff we want to smuggle in underneath, right? Racism, xenophobia, queerphobia, and so on. It's just a really good way. I'll give you one. I know I'm talking a lot. I'll give you one example.
No, it's fine. Well, an example I was thinking of, which I think you discussed in your podcast, is Steve Bannon. I believe you discussed, like, he's not generally interested in Christianity. He's into Buddhism in his own way. But I don't know if you had another example you wanted to talk about, but I keep thinking of him over the last few minutes. So.
No, Bannon's a great example, right? Bannon's Catholic supposedly, but you know, he's very uninterested in anything but a kind of white ethno state. Right. But his faith was a way for him to talk to the DeVos family, talk to the, the preachers, the Paula Whites, when they were all in the White House sort of like, atmosphere. And so that's a really great example, right? Another good example is a couple of years ago, in the wake of the George Floyd murder, you know, a lot of the sporting events or people are kneeling, people are doing all kinds of stuff. So there's a baseball game and everybody kneels on both teams, right? Before the game, except for one guy in the Mets. And, he doesn't do it. So of course, after the game, reporters are like, hey pal, you know, you were the only one who didn't kneel, you know, what's your deal? And he said, well, I can't kneel. I'm a Christian. And if you're a reporter there, right, you got to take a breath because it's like you're not allowed to say something bad about being Christian. If you do, now you're the bad guy, right? And so now you got to pick your words wisely. Okay, so you're a Christian and you can't kneel. How come? Well, I only kneel for God. Okay, I'm a reporter, right? What do I do here? That's probably it. I got to write it down and I'm moving on. There's my story. And people, when I put the quote in the newspaper, it's going to say he can't kneel because he only kneels for God. Folks asked him later, hey, we didn't know you were a Christian. What church do you go to? And he said, I haven't been to church in a long time. I don't go to church. Right. he's the only dude not kneeling for the George Floyd protest. White guy, clearly, right, standing out here. If he says, hey, I'm white, I'm not kneeling for that, he's fired. I mean, he literally, the team, I think, would have gotten rid of him, right? If he says police, they're just doing their job, right? They killed that man and that was their job. He's probably, but if you say, hey, I can't kneel, I'm a Christian, now you're a hero to a lot of Christians. The reporter has nothing to say and you're good. Nobody bothered him and he's off and running, right? That's Christian nationalism on the ground, right? That's how it works. You know, it's a great cover for a lot of unsavory things. But it's hard to penetrate that cover in a way that doesn't make you look like you just hate religion, hate faith, hate Christianity, whatever else.
Yeah, there's I think with Christian nationalism, in my head, there's always a question of how many people actually buy into it, right? Because I think Ross Douthat, who's a conservative, and he's a really thoughtful guy if you read him, I think he makes the argument kind of along the lines of what you just did, that he would say that a lot of the people that buy into Christian nationalism, Trumpism, the mega nation, may be Christian using a label, but, you know, how often are they actually involved in church and things like that? And then you have, you know, the David Frenches out there who have been consistently criticizing Trump. And he's obviously a very conservative guy. If we had David French on and we were talking about political issues, you know, we probably all disagree with him down the line on most of that stuff. And then you have kind of, you know, I know conservatives who are opposed to transgender rights. They're pro-life. They believe in limited government, they say, rugged individualism. I always ask them, like, well, if you're rugged individualist, why don't you leave trans people alone? You know, like, let's be individuals. But anyways, that's kind of beside the point. But you know, they believe in those things. But if you pressed them and said, do you think this should be a Christian nation? They would say, you know, no, there's a separation of church and state, or in the Constitution, it says that the government shouldn't set up a church. Like, we want religious freedom, but we shouldn't be a church. So that's the question of, there's different flavors of conservatives and different, you know, there's a lot of nuance there. But I guess, do you have data on the people that we're talking about, Christian nationalists? Like, how much of the conservative movement or the Republican Party is like, this is a Christian nation, we need to make it so, we're in trouble? You know, what does the data say?
Yeah. You know, for me, the best resource is Sam Perry and Andrew Whitehead's Taking America Back for God. And in there, what they do is they break it down according to a kind of spectrum, I think, in the way you're kind of talking about, Dave. And so what they would do is say, look, we have people who are ambassadors of Christian nationalism. These are the folks who when they answer the survey questions, it's clear. They think this is a Christian nation. It should be a Christian nation. We should be reading the Bible in public schools. We should be teaching the Bible in public schools. The Ten Commandments should be outside of every government building. We should have a closer relationship between Christianity and the federal government, the state government, the local government. Maybe we should only have Christian candidates, right? Maybe you should have to swear in on the Bible. We can go on down the line. And then there's people who are kind of accommodators, right? That person who says, yeah, this is a Christian nation. I believe that. I believe that the likes of Thomas Jefferson or John Adams or George Washington or any of those guys were Christians. I think they wanted to create a nation in a Christian vein, and I'm a Christian. So I think that's best. Now, does that mean that I think if you're Jewish or you're Muslim, you're not allowed to be here? No. Does that mean that if you're not religious, you can't be here? No. But if I had my way, yeah, I'm going to vote for people, Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or anyone down the line who kind of, yeah, they kind of talk like that, right? Christian nation, Christian founding, Christian values, family, you know, Judeo-Christian ethics. That sounds good to me, right? That is a surprising number of folks in the country, right? Like, you're talking, I mean, when it comes to when it comes to white Americans, I mean, you're talking in the 30, high 30%, right? At least leading into the 40s. And then if you kind of keep going, you really get the picture that close to half of folks in, you know, white folks in the country are somewhere on that spectrum. Now, not all of them are the extremists. Not all of them are the fascists, but they at least have a tint, right? Of the cross and the flag, they kind of belong together. Right. That those two, when I go to worship, I mean, I don't know about y'all, but like when I was growing up, the American flag and the Christian flag were next to each other in the sanctuary.
I started every morning with a pledge to the American flag, the Christian flag, and the Bible with coordinated hand movements for each.
Yeah. Right. I mean, and people
I thought about just saying those at the beginning of this episode, actually.
Well, and so there was this guy in my church who was, you know, he was the cranky old guy. Didn't say a lot, but when he did, you know, you didn't want to be on his bad side. He drove the bus for the youth event. He fixed the sound equipment. He fixed up stuff around the church that needed help. He, you know, refurbished the pews. He was that guy, right? He was that guy in the church. He was there since the church started in the 60s. And it was funny. I got a call from a friend a couple years ago and said, hey, you know, he left. He's no longer there. I said, that can't be. He's the lifeblood of the church. He's been there since it started. I can't even imagine the place without him. What happened? Well, the new music minister took the American flag out of the sanctuary. So he says he's not coming back. You know, half a century at the church and he's done. He's not coming back. Now, maybe it's a little more complicated than that, but here's the thing. Did I ever hear that guy say that if you're Muslim, you can't live here? No. Did I ever hear that guy say that if you're not a Christian, you can't be a senator. I didn't. But is that Christian nationalism? Yeah, you better believe it, right? I mean, you better believe that that's Christian nationalism, that if you can't worship without the American flag in your sanctuary, you know, you're on the spectrum, right? You're there. And what happened in the Trump years is those folks got activated. Those folks got, they got exacerbated down the line in terms of their political views, their cultural views. And so, you know, now we are where we are in terms of our politics and our current situation.
Patriarchal nature of evangelical Christianity makes it really interesting to see the rise of folks like Marjorie Taylor Greene, where, you know, we saw that, you know, the data showed that people abandoned their supposed principles when they voted for Trump and stopped thinking that it mattered if somebody was moral. And I'm wondering if their firm belief in only male leaders would also be thrown out the window if she ends up running for president. But you had a series of episodes in your podcast about masculinity and about purity culture, and it had a really interesting connection to white Christian nationalism, particularly with Josh Hawley, who has made, you know, as a politician, he decides to go on an like anti-masturbation crusade and things like that. But I just wondering if you could take a little bit to talk about that series and about this connection that you saw. It's called Mild at Heart. I didn't write the subtitle of it.
It's Love, Masculinity, and Sex After Purity Culture.
Right. And, yeah. And we've talked to some folks on here about purity culture issues. And you talk in this series about, yes, you're a cishet man talking about purity culture. There are many, many wonderful memoirs from women about its impact in their lives. I've personally been trying to find a good resource for discussing that from the perspective of a man who went through a purity culture and the specific weight put on us that I experienced. And I found this series to be pretty remarkable, pretty moving. So I just wanted to thank you for doing that. And the episode talking about how purity culture teaches men to hate themselves twice.
Yeah.
Just wondering if you could talk about that idea a little bit and then connect the series to what we're talking about tonight primarily.
Yeah, totally. Well, thanks for listening. It's flattering that you listened. And you know, when I did the series, I wanted to be very clear, right? That it was not about anything but trying to help men heal, because if we heal, we help ourselves, and then that helps others. And we learned a lot of toxic things, a lot of harmful things, I think, in purity culture, and that hurts us and it hurts others. So it's not about competing. It's not about like, there's so many great, you know, Linda K. Klein's book is amazing, and Jamie Lee Finch's book is amazing, and Julian, you know, yeah, I mean, those books, I've devoured so many of those. It's not about where's ours, right? It has nothing to do with that. It's just all about like we have been told, and I understand why, that purity culture affects women in asymmetrical, undue ways in relation to men. I agree with that. Please don't mishear me that way either. But it's also really damaging to men, even if you're a straight man, even if you're a cis man. And we've got a lot of healing to do. And if we don't admit that it hurt us, then we can't heal. And if we're always saying, well, it didn't hurt me the most, then we'll never heal. And not only will that hurt us, but it'll hurt all the people around us, partners, friends, children, so on. So anyway, that's why I did the series. Just want to be clear about that. I think purity culture teaches men to hate themselves twice for these reasons. You're first taught that you're supposed to squash every sexual urge and desire, that it is from Satan, that you should not trust your body, that you should see your flesh as an evil, vehicle that has been obviously subdued by sin and has just overwhelming sinful urges. Not to take everybody back too far, but you know, when you're 14 and 16 and 18, that's a lot to ask. And what it does is it sets you up for failure. You're going to fail. And let's just be clear. Purity culture does not say don't have sex before marriage. Purity culture says that if you have a sexual thought, you're committing adultery. Okay. And so whatever that means, a sexual thought in any way, as a 14-year-old, a 16-year-old, a 20-year-old, okay, you hate yourself because you're going to fail that test. Most people, everybody's different. Everybody's sexuality is different. Recognize that. A lot of folks are going to fail that test 100 times a day, 1,000 times a day. I don't know how many times a day, right? And so you're going to just feel on a not a weekly basis, a moment by moment basis, right? That if I'm at school and I take a second look at that girl who I think is cute in my English class, if I walk by the 7-Eleven and there's someone in a bikini on the front of the cover and I looked too long, or I saw it and I didn't look away, I don't know. It doesn't matter. You're going to feel like you are a disgusting, vile, putrid individual. And that's what happens in purity culture, right? Okay. So what's the answer? The answer is small group, resist, confess, pray, some of us have been there. And then you get married, right? So I got married at 20 and it's like, okay, you're free now. Go for it, right? All of the delights of the flesh within God's plan. But what you've been told your whole life is that you are a sexual animal, that men are sexual animals and women are loving animals who just want sex for love and intimacy, and men want it because they're disgusting, vile, sexual creatures, right? So the expectation from yourself and the expectation from your partner, your wife, is that you're a disgusting, vile, sexual creature who wants nothing but sex all the time. And so now you're married and you don't want to have sex 9 times a day. You don't want to have sex 5 times a day. Maybe you want to, everyone's different. It's a very private thing. But for most people, sex 7 times a day is just not on the table. And so you're kind of like, what's wrong with me?
So much laundry.
There's a lot involved. There's a lot involved, a lot of showering.
There's some dishes to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dishes.
It's a whole thing. But now you're like, I'm not a real man. I'm not what they said I was supposed to be, which is this amazing sexual Olympian who belongs on the pantheon of sexual virility. And my wife is like, hey, what am I? You don't want me? You don't like me? Did I do something wrong? We had sex once today. You don't want to have sex 6 more times? What's going on? You're not a real man. I'm not a real woman. Things are terrible. And so now I hate myself again. Right. And to me, that's the lose-lose there of purity culture. And how it does, Linda K. Klein says men are taught to hate their minds and women are taught to hate their bodies. But, I would just say I did hate my body. My body led me into sin and it was this awful piece of flesh. I remember thinking, I wish I was blind. There was a lot of chemical castration in the 90s. I don't know why that was so prevalent in the 90s for like criminals and stuff, like sex criminals. I remember thinking, oh, I wish they would just like castrate me. Like if I could take a potion and have no more sexual desire, that'd be awesome. Right. And so I did hate my body. And then even when I got married, I hated my body because I was like, I'm not a sexual Olympian. I'm just not. And so I guess my body sucks again, I can talk more about how that links to Christo fascism and Christian nationalism, but that's kind of the beginning for me with that whole idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. So how does that link up?
So it links up very tightly to what it means to be a man, right? So to me, we always think of purity culture as about sex, right? It's about sex, sex, sex. And you go to church and you're not supposed to have sex or think about sex. And then every other youth group meeting seems to be about sex. It's pretty incredible stuff. Purity culture is also just about gender. We're going to separate the girls and the boys. Here's how to be a girl. Here's how to be a respectable young woman. Here's how to be a man. And the man stuff, right, is not so much, and this is where I totally agree with Linda K. Klein, it's not so much about modesty and thinking of your body as a stumbling block. But it is about gendered ways of becoming the right kind of man, that the right kind of man is wild at heart, right? So John Eldridge says, you're an adventurer. you're a knight. You go out on these marauding, you know, journeys, and you have a fire inside of you that can't be quenched, and you're going to take what you want and rescue the woman in the castle who's under duress and be the hero of your story and her story too. And you know what that means? You should chop wood and you should build things with your hands. And, you know, that is what it means to be a man. And that kind of notion that if you're going to be a real man, right, that you've got to embody this picture of strength and virility, decision-making and aggression. And the final say comes with me. There's no backseat. There's no reflection. That's the model of manhood. And if you don't live up to that, you're not a real man. So if we play that out into politics and Josh Hawley and that whole bit, Josh Hawley loves talking about fathers. Oh, this country would be so much better if our fathers were present and our kids weren't playing video games all the time. And we still had men around who were men and they were disciplining people and get off the pornography and get off the video games and actually get out here and discipline your kids. Right. And what he's really saying is, right, if you're a real man, you will conduct your family and your business in a way that you're the decision maker. You do not ask questions. You do not empathize. You do not think about how to explain or communicate. You simply do. And the people in your family, your wife and your children, they listen and obey. That's the model. And if we had that model, we'd be better off. Don't get me wrong. That model is awful for women. It is terrible for children. But it's also terrible for men because it teaches you that unless you play that part, and some people are really good at playing the part, even if they hate it. Some of us are really bad at playing the part, like me, okay? But unless you play that part, you're not a real man. So in purity culture, I'm not a real man if I don't want to have sex 9 times a day. I'm not a real man unless I chop wood and I yell at my wife in public, right? And so now all of a sudden, we've got a really toxic blend here of gender and masculinity and sexuality.
And it ties right into Putin and evangelicals' long embrace of him and Russia's crackdown on gender expression and sexuality. I mean, you know, Putin has gone out of his way over the years to, you know, to be have photographs disseminated of him, you know, shirtless on horseback or like hunting bear or something, you know, like he's been presenting himself constantly as the ultimate man. Yeah. And I think that's likely what a lot of Christian nationalists were initially drawn to over there, and they would contrast that with, you know, the
you know, Obama dad jeans.
Is effete the right word for this? How they would perceive, yeah, Obama? You know, what kind? You know, a president that puts out, you know, lists every year of his favorite music and books and movies, which are always incredible.
He has good taste.
He has really good taste. But you know, Franklin Graham was going over to Russia years and years ago, right?
Yep.
And I think you talked about this or shared an article about the Russian Orthodox Church, mm-hmm, making connections with Franklin Graham when he came over there, and then them coming over here, and the you know, the Russian Orthodox Church is basically a wing of the government there, right?
Well, and so if we go to Putin and we think about purity culture, you're like, what is that? What does Putin have to do with purity culture? And for me, it's like this. It's like Putin is the father of his nation in the way that purity culture thinks you should be the father of your household, right? Putin, mm-hmm, doesn't ask questions. He doesn't accept difference. If you talk back, you get punished. If you bring something into his household that he doesn't approve of, he just gets rid of it. He doesn't ask you about it. He doesn't want to know why. He doesn't want to understand your feelings. He doesn't want to vote. He doesn't care. Putin is a real man with no shirt on, riding a horse. And if you cross him, right, you will pay for it. Now the payoff is he protects you from all the invaders. And that's what purity culture says. As a man, you don't empathize with your wife. You don't listen to your kids. You don't act patiently. You have the role of protecting everybody from the invader.
And there are always invaders.
Always.
They are always waiting for the slightest show of weakness to come in. So he's been telling his people for years that the Ukrainians are an imminent threat, right?
Ukrainians, Muslims, right? Doesn't matter. And to me, that's where Putin becomes this emblem for the white Christian nationalist man. Like, we need that guy. That's the kind of guy I want to be in my household. That's the kind of guy I want leading my nation. So Putin now becomes this Christian nationalist hero in a way that's really grotesque. And you're like, well, that came out of nowhere. And it didn't. Paul Ryrick, the architect of the religious right, he started going to Russia in the 90s. Dana Rohrabacher, the guy that Kevin McCarthy famously said thinks Putin pays, right? Dana Rohrabacher was
Orange County, right?
Orange County, from where I'm from. He was this pro-Putin congressperson. Rohrabacher had this famous arm wrestling match with Putin way back in the early 90s. And they end up being pals. And Rohrabacher's like, this guy's incredible. He's a real man. He's a real leader. And at the time, people are like, God, man, you got to get off the Russian train. Now what? What are all those folks saying in those spaces? Yeah, Putin's a real leader. Putin's a better leader than Obama ever was. He's a better leader than Biden will ever be. Putin's a real man.
And they're still saying it. That's what I'm saying.
I think Eric Metaxas, Eric Metaxas, who is a very prominent rightward evangelical who wrote the book of all people on Bonhoeffer, which is very, very popular. I think he recently said, yeah, Putin is a real leader as compared to Joe Biden or, I mean, probably just these past like 2 weeks on his, literally on his radio show. It's really wild. Well, a part of your book title, Brad, is what comes next. So here we are, your book's coming out January 6th, 2023. And I mean, while no one has a crystal ball, we don't know the future, but you've been, you know, studying and analyzing these trends. How worried should we all be as to where things are going?
You know, I think, unfortunately, January 6th was the beginning of and not the end of this kind of violence. And you say, well, it's been, you know, however many months now, we haven't had another major insurrection uprising in that vein. But my argument would be, okay, look around at all the little fires, as Sarah Posner calls them. Look at the violence, the aggression, the lack of safety at school board meetings. Look at the ways healthcare workers have been assaulted and harassed. Look at the way that it feels unsafe, right, in so many spaces in our public square. So you can tell me, oh, we haven't had another January 6th yet. And I'll say, well, look around on a moment-by-moment basis. It's harder to feel the water start to boil when you're in the water in the pot already as the little frog. So I think that's happening already. We have a trucker convoy that's now circling the Beltway. Now, is that going to lead to some sort of massive event? It doesn't look like it. But a couple of weeks ago, it kind of looked like it could have turned into that, right? We might have had something along the lines of what happened in Canada.
More Jericho theming.
A lot of Jericho
to do.
and I always say, I've said it on my show so often, I think people are tired of it, but like, y'all grew up with the story of Jericho. Hey, march around and believe God. And it's a story about faith. It's a story about not letting the impossible slip through your fingers. You know, Jericho's a story about story about attempted genocide. That's what Jericho's about. So this rhetoric to me has only gotten worse. And in my book, I point to something that's sort of in y'all's backyard, which is the MAGA migration to what is called the American Redoubt. And a lot of folks identify the regions of Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, and then parts of Eastern Washington and Eastern Oregon as what's now called the American Redoubt, a refuge.
And that's R-E-D-O-U-B-T, like doubt, not read out, redoubt. Okay.
Redoubt, yeah.
So redoubt meaning like a refuge. And so what you have is people seeing that region as the last refuge of where you can create the real America. And so people are moving there in droves. Boise is one of the fastest growing cities in the country. It will reach 1 million people in about 15 years. If you look at home prices in those places, it is through the roof. But you have folks in the American Redoubt movement who are calling openly for theocracy. They're calling openly for, as you just said, Zach, stockpiling guns and getting ready for the next civil war. You have leaders like Matt Shea, who used to be a state congressperson, who's now a pastor, who have written manifestos that say, if you do not submit to a Christian government, you should kill all the men who do not submit, right? And I can show you that text if you'd like to see it later.
Yeah,
so
I remember seeing that.
We have the blueprint for the MAGA migration and what is coming next. It is happening already. and you say, well, where are the people moving from? They're moving from California. They're moving from Washington. Oh, aren't the Californians and the Seattleites and their latte drinking, aren't they making Idaho and Montana more liberal? You know what they're doing? They're making it more conservative, because all those folks who are the most conservative in those places are leaving to congregate in the American Redoubt. I grew up, as I said, in Southern California. I could probably find you 100 people in Idaho that I grew up with who have left Orange County, right?
My best friend in high school got a scholarship to New St. Andrews.
Yep.
I don't know if the school provides scholarships, but it was like a guy with means that was connected to like his little Baptist church knew that he wasn't going to be able to go to college without some help, and he was philosophically minded and conservative, so he paid for him to go out there. And I had a Zoom call for a couple hours with him, catching up maybe 6 months ago or so. Initially he was like, maybe come on the podcast. And you know, he was like, he doesn't live there anymore, but it's a very tight-knit town. And you know, he knew Doug personally.
Yep.
And had been in small groups with him many, many times. And it's wild how much influence that guy has. Growing up in the Pacific Northwest, I just don't really think about Idaho very much, except, you know, I had the longstanding association with the northernmost part of it being, you know, like a neo-Nazi enclave.
Yep.
And for folks that don't understand Washington, you know, the mountains divide Washington into two very distinct halves, where I think we're the only state in the country that has a rainforest and a desert. Over on the east side of the state, it's a desert climate. It gets very hot and very cold. It's very dry. And over on the Seattle side, we have an actual rainforest on the peninsula there. And it tends to be, you know, more left-leaning people on the west side of Washington, and a way different political climate on the east side.
Yeah.
And there's been talk for many, many years about splitting the state in two. But I mean, how likely do you think this readout idea is to actually be able to carve out its own territory?
You know, there's a lot of political challenges to that. You know, the economic consequences would be just devastating. I don't know that folks realize how much they rely on the Seattles and the, the Portlands and the, Salt Lake Cities and the other things for resources, much less the federal government's kickback, in terms of, funding and things like that. So that's a whole other conversation I'll leave to economists and political scientists. But what I would say is that if we think about Christian, if we just come back to the beginning, Christian nationalism as an ethno-traditionalist identity, Christian nationalism as a cultural marker, I'm not talking about, do you do your small group and your quiet time? I'm talking, I'm a white person who believes in a white America and a white Christian America. And I don't want to be around non-binary people or people who speak with an accent or people who don't look like me. Well, this is the place to look in the country. This is where it's happening, right? So I know we're running out of time. I'll say, when I grew up in Orange County, it was predominantly white. You know, we're biracial, we're some of the few Asian kids around, right? These days, Orange County is very purple. It went for Hillary Clinton in 2016. There's a brand new Japanese market, like two blocks from where I grew up, which is would have never happened when I was a kid. There's pho counters and sushi restaurants and taquerias, right? All over. And you can see it. You can see it happening. The diversity of America happening. The liberal politics sort of taking place. The acceptance of the LGBT community, etc. What's happening is not that all those hearts and minds of the militant white identity folks have changed. I am not exaggerating. They have all moved to Idaho. They have all left. Now,
knew like 50 people personally.
Yeah. Yes. I'm not making that up. Like I'm telling you, if I went to Boise right now, I could find 50 people within a day who I grew up with somehow in church and school. And here's the thing that's so scary. There are some of them that went up there and they'll tell you, oh yeah, I want to be around white people. Idaho is 97% white. I want to be there. I don't like all the Vietnamese and the Chinese. And the Mexican folks around me in Orange County. I don't want that. I'm getting out of here. Some of them will say that. You know what the others will say? Look, we just, you know, Orange County's crowded. It's expensive. We kind of just want to be in a place where we can just be at church and have a good community. And, you know, and it goes back to what you said, Dave, right? Like there's people on the spectrum, right? There's people who are not the extremists, but here's the thing. Why are they all moving to a place that is full of the extremists? That's not going to go well. That's how you radicalize people, right?
Yeah.
When I tell these friends and family, hey, why don't y'all move to Memphis? Cheap as hell to live in Memphis. There's a nice river called the Mississippi there. That's good. Do it. Why don't we do Santa Fe? Why don't we do Tucson? Oh, I don't know. It's because you know why? You know what? Idaho is the whitest state in the country. It's the most homogeneous place you could go. And in state politics, sorry, y'all got me going. I know we got to wrap up.
No, it's
if good. You got time, we got time.
but okay. So think about it with me. All right. Think about it for a minute. You're like, well, come on, Brad, you know, look, like Georgia's super red, you know, they had an election and Stacey Abrams worked a miracle, but you know, that's a super red place with a lot of white, you know, folks that don't want diversity. Okay. How about, you know, Pennsylvania, you know, middle of Pennsylvania, that happens. That's where my brother lives. Right. Let's talk about Minnesota. I don't know. We got a lot of white folks, right? Here's the thing. Georgia has Atlanta. It's always going to have Atlanta. Atlanta is always going to tilt the state in a way that if you want to do state politics, you got to contend with Atlanta, right? And that's going to mean diversity. There's so many black folks and Asian folks and so much diversity in Atlanta. Let's go to Louisiana. We got New Orleans. We got Minneapolis, right? We got Pittsburgh and Philly. We got Baltimore. There is none of that in Idaho or Montana. There is no metropolis that tilts the state back in any sort of like moderate way. Mm-hmm. There's no center that says, yeah, y'all might get a little extremist over there, but we have enough state senators and enough of a like urban sort of center that you can't. I mean, Texas has Austin, right? Texas has Houston. I mean, seriously, right? I mean, even my brother used to live in Denton. Have you been to Houston? Have you been to Austin? There is nowhere at all like that in Idaho or Montana. Nowhere. Yeah. So if you want to create your white Christian nationalist utopia, you don't go to Texas. You don't go to Colorado because you're at Denver. Everybody's smoking weed and having a good time. You don't go to those places. You got to go to the one region in the state where there's no state capital urban center that's going to make you be moderate. That's going to talk back. So that's where you go. And that's where they're going. And that's Trump could die tonight. And MAGA would continue in my mind.
God, he almost did.
Because of the
I saw he is this confirmed? Did this happen? He was on a plane where the engines went out over the Gulf of Mexico and he landed safely. And fuck, I was just like, I gotta pray harder. so close.
I honestly don't wish for him to die. I just hope he faces justice, but I don't know that he will.
I don't think he ever will.
I mean, there's so many crimes. I mean, it's like where do you even start?
I know it's terrible to say it, but I've accepted that's what I want for that guy. because so that's a perfect segue into the last thing. I just speaking about trauma. I am currently seeing a therapist who specializes in religious trauma syndrome, and it has been a wonderful way of helping to understand myself and the way I'm wired and the things that I can change about how I see the world and the things that are just like so deeply rooted in me because of evangelicalism always being the center of my life until the last few years. It's amazing. And there's not enough therapists that specialize in religious trauma. It's incredible that I found one that actually worked with my insurance. And it's been an amazing experience. So you work with the Center for Trauma Resolution and Recovery, and specifically dealing with religious trauma. Could you just talk a little bit about that and the resources that are available to people?
Yeah, totally. So the CTRR was started by Laura Anderson, who's amazing. If y'all look her up on Instagram, she's basically created a place that focuses exactly as you said, Zach, on religious trauma, people who are dealing with everything from recovering from purity culture, leaving ministry, you know, sort of toxic household situations related to religion and so on. And so, yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you said. It's one of the few places that really offers an entire team that is trained and focused on religious trauma and what that means. It's amazing how transformative that can be, because as good as a therapist might be, as good as a coach might be, a practitioner, a counselor, it just really helps if you're talking to someone who understands the culture of where you've been and what you've been through, at least in some general way. They know the lingo, they know the symbols, they know the decoder rings, they know all that kind of stuff. And so that's what happens at CTRR. And if you're interested in that, both myself and my co-host Dan Miller are practitioners there. There's a whole team of folks, men and women, people who specialize in working with members of the LGBTQ community, and so on. And so, you know, marriage stuff, relationship stuff, sexuality, gender, everything you can think of. So it's hard to explain how fulfilling it is to talk with folks about these issues, because they're so prevalent, they're so hard to navigate. I don't know about y'all. I left evangelicalism in 2005, 2006. That stuff hits me at least once per day. At least once per day, I have a thought or something that happens in my body related to something 15 years ago. And so I guess for me, that's kind of just how it works. That's how trauma works. It lives in your body, and it's really hard to recover and heal from. And so if you can find somebody to help you through that, that's the best.
It's so valuable for them to understand your experience and understand the inherently toxic culture of that experience. So like I saw a therapist who was a Christian at one point, and I felt like I need to find a Christian therapist so they understand me. And then I saw, after I left church, I saw a therapist who had no background in faith. And I was like, all right, I need to find somebody who's like not going to tell me to go back to church. So that works. But then he couldn't speak the language really at all. And finding somebody that both understood the language, understood the culture, and wasn't doing this so that he could convince me that the best way to heal is to find a good church that knew the damage that churches cause to people is real, was transformative. And I can't understate how powerful, I can't overstate how powerful it was. So I'm so glad that you're doing this, that there's a growing number of therapists that understand these issues and can help people. There's so many people with trauma from religion, and they don't need to see somebody and be judged for having a negative experience with the church. So
I also think too, it's important to say, you don't have to have that. You don't have to have one thing that happened that was really, really, really bad to say that you meet the bar.
Right.
Right. Right. Like, you know, so many folks come to the CTR and they say, you know, I wasn't sure if I should come because I didn't have that, you know, I didn't have that really, 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 really terrible life defining moment of a sexual assault or a something else, you know, a physical abuse from a pastor, you know, whatever it may be. I didn't have that. So I didn't think I qualified. Right. And I just want to say, don't do that. If you feel like you want and need to talk to someone about this stuff, you qualify.
I mean, elements of the doctrine can be traumatic enough for you. Fear of hell, fear of the rapture, I want to say transubstantiation, but I mean, penal substitutionary atonement, stuff like that. Just general feeling that you can't trust your body, you can't trust your heart. There's so much in there. So thank you so much, Brad, for coming on the show. It's really been a joy to talk to you. your show, Straight White American Jesus, is such a valuable resource, such a great place to go to gain a clearer understanding of, you know, what's going on right now with Russia and Ukraine and all that. But at the same time, having episodes like this, talking about purity culture and all that, it's a beautiful program, Brad.
Oh, well, thank you. That's too much, but, I appreciate you. You know, that's really kind. Thank you very much. Yeah.
And we both look forward to reading your book. Absolutely.
Yeah. Preparing for War, January 6th. Where can people find you on the internet? Last question, if they want to look you up.
Yeah. Best places, Twitter at Brad Leonishi. The show is at Straight White JC. And, I'm less so on Instagram and Facebook. So you can always email us, straightwhiteamericanjesus@gmail.com. Thanks for having me, y'all. I feel like I talked a lot, so you got me going.
We like that.
I try to not talk too much.
Yeah.
So get away from my white maleness. No. Like, it's been too long since I've spoken. I gotta pop in with something. Well, Dave, that was a super informative conversation, super useful, especially if anybody listening is looking for where they could move to be in an all-white enclave.
No, thank you.
Idaho's the place to go, apparently. So,
no, thank you. Yeah,
I'm guessing if that's a goal of yours, you probably didn't make it far enough into the podcast to hear that.
yeah, you know, off of this topic, if switching gears, I watched Michelle and I watched Drive My Car last night.
Oh, yeah.
3 hours.
How about that, like, opening credits hitting at the like 45 minute mark?
Yeah, 45 minutes. People have told me about that before, so I was prepared.
I forgot though when it happened. So I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, right. But I thought it was one of the final scenes where they're putting on this play, and there's a woman from Taiwan who speaks English. There's the main character who is Japanese. Hiroshima is where a lot of the film takes place, or pretty much all of it, I guess. And there's a Korean woman who does sign language. And you remember how she's signing, you know, because the guy has all this trauma in his life based on his wife dying, just regrets and conflicts they had in their relationship and things she didn't tell him. And so he's just very sad. And there's this Korean woman was signing him a hopeful message about, you know, someday, I think, you know, you'll be before a God who pities you, but I think she meant it in a way of a God who empathizes with your pain. Mm-hmm. And there will be rest. So I thought, man, there's like a eschatological, like, faith-based hope at the end of this movie. And it's not cheesy. Like, it, you know, it seemed very sincere. I always want to put nuances on that theology, because I think it's important that people live now. You know, in my Christian mind, God's given us this life now. We can't wait around for something else to happen in the future. It's important to face grief and pain and sadness now and kind of walk through that. But I did think that was a lovely, you know, beautiful moment to the movie. And it's, it was a good one. It's on HBO Max right now, streaming.
Yeah, that's definitely recommend it for folks that are more okay with slower or contemplative films.
Yep.
You know, it's purposefully having a very zen-like tone to it, with sort of repeating certain scenes over and over and things like that. But yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's kind of conventional. I think Jeffrey Overstreet was talking about that, where the camera is like pointing at someone talking, pointing at the other person talking, and a lot of it's dealing with such strong emotional thematic matter. Some of it seems kind of stoic to me, but I mean, it's just it's kind of the style that it was made in. I thought it was very good.
Yeah, very, very restrained in a lot of ways. So
absolutely.
It made me think of, like, Tokyo Story, you know, some of those classic Ozu films that are, you know, very, very slow and deliberate, but very beautiful. So yeah, glad you saw that.
Thanks for listening to us. You can leave a rating, a review, wherever you like to get podcasts for our show. You can find us at VCW Pod on Twitter. I am at Dave J. Lester. Zach is at Muzak, M-U-Z-A-C-H. And you can visit Zach's website to get some of his music, to buy his vinyl record, to hear some of his newer songs. Muzak.bandcamp.com. Music and logo by Zach.
Thanks for coming on down to the VCW. And remember, as always, the podcast is free. You still need to tithe 10%. And I would suggest, if you're able, that you put that tithe towards Ukraine, the various relief organizations helping out there. I don't like to like toot my own horn about stuff, but you know, we gave to the World Central Kitchen, Chef Jose Andres, you know, providing meals for Ukrainian refugees and such. And there's all sorts of other organizations that you could give to, and that would be lovely. Yeah. If you have the means to do so, please think about it.
I was thinking today that Michelle and I are going to do that, need to do that. Some of the hardest part is researching charities, because there's so many scams out there. I mean,
right. You know, that's why we gave to this one. We
right.
knew that they're a legit organization. That's
cool. That's a good one. People. Yeah. So to go online, do some research. I think there's some websites that actually rate charities, you know, so make sure it's actually going to people that can help. Ukrainian refugees, or even in some cases, Russian refugees. I don't think that's being talked about enough, that there are Russian soldiers deserting the battlefield because they don't agree with this war.
Right.
So we need to take care of those people too. This is a horrible situation for everybody. But anyway, yeah, let's look to give and help people. So.
All right. Thanks for talking with me again, Dave.
Yeah.
And with our guest, Brad. Thanks for coming on, Brad. All right, everybody. Until next time.
Good day, or whatever.
I already said the catchphrase. Goodbye.